For those of you that have not met us, I'm Brian, and this is my friend Justin. And we are here every other Tuesday, except when we're not. And that brings me to the next one of these is going to be on May 26th, I think it is.
That's
Is that
right.
right?
Yeah.
Normally it would be May 19th, but we're having an all-church planning retreat where all of our staff will be gone. So we'll be in the mountains, but we'll be back here on the 26th for part two of Against the Machine. If you are new, one of the things you'll notice is there's some little QR codes scattered around the room. The top one will allow you to ask any question anonymously that you might have. And then Matthew, hopefully, will be our moderator, and we will be able to address those. But we will start off by talking about this book that we are both very excited about. And how many of you have ever heard of the book Against the Machine before tonight?
All right, we got
Okay,
two
all right.
hands.
Good.
How many of you have heard of Paul Kingsnorth? The same two hands. Great. All
Okay,
right.
all right,
This is
good.
going to be
So
fun.
it will be fun. So one of the things about this book is it has been kind of a bombshell in multiple different areas. It has been written up in pretty much every magazine, literary thing that you could think of, The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and reviewers don't quite know what to make of this book. And part of the reason they don't know what to make of it is they want it to be a political diatribe, and so they want to be able to pigeonhole it as either a left thing or a right thing. But you can't do that with this book, and so it's making people sort of crazy. And the book has become a huge bestseller, both in the United States and in the UK and in Ireland, which is where Paul Kingsnorth lives. Do you want to give us a little background on who Paul Kingsnorth is?
So, yeah, he used to be a journalist, I believe. I can't remember where he was educated or where he was a journalist, but I know he traveled the world. But then he ended up essentially becoming a writer and living in the western part of Ireland, bought his own kind of farm and totally kind of went off the grid, so
Yep.
to speak, and has started being a writer. And I remember listening to this book not that long ago and was texting Brian. I was like, Brian, there's so many amazing parts of this book, but everything that you just said about it doesn't fit into progressive or
Categories, yes.
conservative, Democrat, Republican categories. And yet it was touching so many things that I've felt in my own lived experience that resonated with me, as well as ministering to young people. Like, I was just really excited that you ended up reading it and we can talk about it.
Yes. And part of what's interesting about Paul Kingsnorth's background is he is a genius, for one. But the other thing that's interesting is that for the whole time he was growing up, he had a really deep love for nature and for the environment. And so he became a radical climate activist.
Right.
And when I say radical, I mean radical. So, like, not like Greenpeace. He was like
Chaining himself.
way sort of almost a, I don't even know what you would call it, but yeah, exactly. So that's where he was coming from. But he got very disillusioned with that movement because he felt like it had been co-opted, and he can make a pretty good case about that, that it had been co-opted by big business, big tech, and all of that. And so he, a lot of his understanding of who he was caught up in that cause. And so he started trying to figure out, okay, well, what does it mean that I'm alive? And he, for a while, got really into being a Wiccan. And so he delved deeply into that, but didn't find it satisfying, and then started reading more and talking more, and then eventually, through a really cool pilgrimage, ended up having a radical and deep conversion to Christianity, where he is in the Orthodox Christian Church. And all the pundits don't know what to do with that either, which is another thing that makes it super fun and interesting to read his work. But he says he is the great irony in himself because he is off the grid, living in the rural part of County Galway in Ireland, raising his own food, no smartphone, but he makes his living through his Substack.
Right.
So he said, you know, I'm using the technology that I'm railing against to survive. So he realizes that he's conflicted, and so he, at least he's honest about that. But he says that this book is the product of really his whole life, and that it is kind of his magnum opus and his screed, if you want to call it that, about the world. But it is fascinating. It is well worth reading, and it's challenging. You know, it is a little bit like trying to drink out of a fire hydrant because there are a lot of ideas coming at you and coming at you pretty fast. So.
And they're not exactly linear. The chapters...
They're not linear at all.
Yeah, that's helpful. So you were saying that they're based... I didn't realize this until we were talking right before, that apparently it's the combination of his whole... Like, a lot of the stuff he wrote on Substack, those essays, have been now... He wrote some material to try to connect it. And it still flows, but it definitely is not linear in the third part and fourth parts of the book. But nevertheless, they're really insightful. And he's just a really good writer, I think.
Yes.
I really enjoyed reading what he has to say. But yeah, his past definitely comes out through the book, as well as his conversion. I think he starts the book off. One of the things that I found really helpful is it really takes how you view the world and what story you see yourself in really makes all the difference in life. And
yeah.
He starts with the story. I think he's even like, let me tell you the story. And he talks about creation and the fall of the human race and that the Christian meta-narrative or story, and then it's not terribly hard to understand kind of that's the framework out of which he's operating, and then he starts to have really insightful analysis about where we are today and how we got here.
Yes, and one of the things that I really appreciate, I don't know how many of you know that David Foster Wallace essay that talks about the fish.
Valediction speech. Sorry,
yes. And David Foster Wallace was a public intellectual, and basically what he's talking about is that if you are a fish and you're swimming in water all the time, you have no idea that you're swimming in water. It's just what you're in. And so somebody tells this fish he's in water, and the fish says, "What's water?" And so sort of the point is that you need to understand the story that you're in. You need to understand the environment that you're in, because if you don't know that, then you are basically, in some ways, a pawn of your environment. And so it's really important to understand that. I think in some ways that's what this whole book is trying to do, is to help us to situate ourselves, those of us that are alive in this 21st century and the culture in which we live, to figure out, what is it that we are swimming in? And are we swimming in water that's good and healthy, that's going to make us flourish? Or are we swimming in water that's toxic? So I would say from that standpoint, the book is very important and it's very thought-provoking. So what were the things that you found most interesting about the book?
Well, I think going off of that, you know, one of the things we talk a lot about is what does it mean to be human? And I really am drawn to people who look at the world the way it is, and actually, you know, over the course of human history, what it meant to be human is X. And yet for us today, what we instinctively think about our humanity is something very different.
Yes.
And so I was drawn to a few of his insights that I found pretty compelling. The idea of, you know, this... We should probably define what the machine is, because he talks about, he's not just saying like machines in general, appliances are bad. He's talking about something far greater than that. Maybe that'd be a place to start, because I think he's right about what this quote unquote machine is that we're in.
Yeah, so he would say the machine is, it's an all encompassing term. It does have a physical reality, which would be all of the devices that are connected with the internet and deal with data and all of that, that's part of the machine, but the machine also includes what you might call the spirit of the age, that is sort of this inevitable push toward what he calls progress, in quotation marks, that that's part of the machine, that this idea of kind of the inevitable movement in this particular direction, that's part of the machine as well, and that the all of the equipment, all of those devices that we have in some ways are kind of the body of the machine, but there is a spirit that is animating that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's not just a railing against smartphones. Like, he actually goes way back, hundreds of years before, and he talks about material conditions, like the way the world as we know it has changed because of, yeah, technology. But we're not, again, just talking about computers. We're talking about the steam engine and the idea that all of a sudden humanity can be mobile and move across continents pretty easily. That changes how you experience human life. And there are unintended consequences mm-hmm. that come from those sorts of things. So I think he puts his finger on a number of things. The material conditions change. There's this, because of the Industrial Revolution in particular, with factories and consumerism and industry, it's all going towards, as you said, quote-unquote progress. And we've kind of just swallowed it wholesale without really thinking about some of the unintended consequences. And just in the last 15, 20, 30 years, we're starting to see the movement of technology become so great that now the questions of what is a human being is more legitimate than ever with things like AI. So I think that it's right to locate, you know, some of the fundamentals and where we started to drift and what most people considered basic human life. And it speaks to the experience that me and so many others that I've talked to, why they feel lonely, why they are anxious, and it really goes, rootedness is one of the mm-hmm, major themes. Mm-hmm. And I think that by looking at it historically, but also through the lens of the material conditions and technology, you're starting to put your finger on why all the felt needs that we experience today are the way that they are.
Yeah.
And it's not the solution that many in the 21st century will give.
Right. Yeah. And one of the things that's interesting is the book cover is really cool because it's this beautiful forest, but it's been messed with. It looks kind of like an old analog screen that is like breaking up a little bit. But the subtitle is on the unmaking of humanity. So obviously the making of humanity is the opposite of the unmaking. And part of what he's getting at is he has a strong, particularly now as a Christian, a strong doctrine of creation. And basically his thesis is that when you boil it down to basics, human beings are born into this world. They're born in bodies that are sexed at birth, and they grow and they have the ability to create things, they have the ability to reason and learn wisdom, and then they die. And that is sort of what, at root, a human being is. And he says what we are doing is what a lot of people would call transhumanism, that we are trying to use technique, technology, the machine, to undo all of those different aspects about what it means to be human, to think of ourselves as Legos that can be taken apart and put together really in any sort of way that we can imagine, that we are pushing back against sex, we are pushing the fact of being male or female, we're pushing back against that, we're pushing back against the fact that we die at some point, and we're trying to undo that. And so we're trying to undo all of these things that are part and parcel of being human. And his thesis is that that is unbelievably risky on all sorts of levels. And part of what he talks about that Justin alluded to is what he calls the great uprooting, that is part and parcel of what we think of as progress of the machine age and the technological age, and this ability that people used to stay in the same place more or less for all their lives, and often for centuries and centuries and centuries. And now, mostly for economic reasons, we now live in a culture where we think the way to optimize is to go to wherever you can make the most money. And that maybe there's some things that are good about that, but the cost of that is far more than we can imagine. And he says, when we have uprooted so much of our culture, we have exchanged what he calls the four P's for the four S's. And so the four P's are people, place, prayer, and past. People, place, prayer, and past. And the S's are sex, screens, self, and
science.
Yes. And so he says the four P's gave people a sense of who they were, that you had an identity that was rooted somewhere, and that you had kind of your people, people who knew you, people who knew your family, a place where there were traditions and rituals. You were very likely part of a church body, and so you were in a place where there was fellowship, and there was a closeness and a belonging and all of that. And that what we have done is we have embraced, instead of those things, seeing sex and sexual desire as the most defining characteristic of our identity, that screens become impossible to live without, to go through the day without screens, that our self, rather than being part of a community or a family or even a group of friends, that our independent, autonomous self is the highest good, to be free of every restraint. And then science, that science or scientism, scientism, the worship of science is saying the only way to know anything is through science, not through right brain, this very left brain sort of way of seeing things, that that's all that reality is. And so reality is taken out of this vast, beautiful, created universe and brought down to a data set.
Yeah, observable. All the mystery and wonder has been evaporated because of that. It's really about, looking at the world as only the natural that can be observed. And, I think one of the things that struck me at the beginning as he's talking about this, this is the story of kind of by and large the Christian faith. And he's like, and imagine people lived by that story for 1,000+ years. And all of a sudden, imagine that the culture and the rituals and the things that they did, that these sets of values that bound them together and what it meant to be human, but also what it meant to be a community. Imagine that because of the Enlightenment, all of that culture has died. And he's like, that's actually, you don't have to imagine it. That's what we're in right now. And he's saying that this experience that we have, where we are basically up to ourselves to create our own meaning and purpose, and all of those things that created those roots, and I love the way he described it, roots are those things by which and to which we are tied down.
Yes.
And I love that, because we don't like, if you like to be told to be tied down, for like existentially, but nobody likes the idea of you can't do what you want. But I think that's exactly what roots do, is that you're bound to a place or a people. Now we've become so quote-unquote free that we believe to use our freedom to do whatever we want. One quick example, and there's another way of, one of the reasons the book was compelling to me is the number of people I've talked to who go 20, 30 times a year to weddings around the nation. And because we have the ability to travel by airplane. And so they just hop on a plane, and they think that it's their community that they're actually growing closer to. But counterintuitively, they're actually losing their roots and their sense of community in a place in the season that they're actually
living. Because they're not ever there.
Because they're all over the place. And I think that was one concrete example of, I was like, oh man, he's right about this. These roots that we have, the traditions, the history, but also our sense of place where we live. We have taken those things for granted, and now I think we're reaping some of the quote-unquote freedom that we've had, because we haven't used it to this social web that we were created for.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And one of the things that, of course, I would appreciate in this book is that it is littered with fairly regular references to The Lord of the Rings and Tolkien. And part of the reason for that is that Lewis and Tolkien both had almost essentially the same argument that the break with the way humanity used to be happened with the Industrial Revolution, and that everything moving after that, there are many good things about it, but that we have over embraced it so that it has become a juggernaut that is causing destruction. And part of the reason that I think people love reading The Lord of the Rings and reading the Narnia stories is they are rooted. And you feel like when you're reading those stories that you are participating in this beautiful, rooted world where good and evil are clear, where beauty is there, where people are experiencing wonder and awe of nature, where progress and machines are viewed with very much skepticism. So, you know, I think all of that part is very resonant. The other thing that's interesting to me is he quotes some people that are sort of out of fashion now. If you studied philosophy or theology, you probably run into Jacques Ellul or Lewis Mumford, and those are people that you don't come up with in everyday conversation, but they're all over this book, and they have important things to say that he ties into. But I think part of what he gets at in the book is that part of the water that we're swimming in that we don't realize that we're swimming in and that we don't realize how dangerous it is, is that limits are bad. And this is sort of the idea of being tied down. And what he says is we are not designed for infinite potentiality. We are not designed to be able to know and care about every single crisis that happens all around the world every single day. We are not designed to be friends with 5,000 people through a social media algorithm. That what we are designed for is real community. And he doesn't say it this way, but you know, it's very interesting when you look at Jesus in the Gospels and you see Jesus calling to himself these 12 disciples. Within those 12 disciples, he has a group of three that are closest, and out of those three, one who's closest. And then he has a group of 70 kind of beyond that. And that's kind of his people. And that is sort of a normal, he doesn't like the word sustainable, but which he has some good reasons for, because he says sustainability has become an industry, which is absolutely right. But that is a human scale, the way you see Jesus with the relationships, that is a human scale sort of way of doing things. And that part of his thesis is that there might be more joy and purpose and meaning in life if we started learning to say no to things, if we started to have more limits, if we started to invest deeply in people, place, prayer, and learning about our past. And I will just say, if you live in Charleston, you've got a huge leg up here, because Charleston, compared to so many places, is a place that is rich in tradition. And part of the reason that tourists love to come here is that there's this feeling of timelessness and rootedness when you walk around in the historic district. And that's because people have lived and loved this place for centuries.
Yeah. You know, the things that you just said about design, I mean, you mentioned that word several times, and I think that's controversial because today, post the Enlightenment, the wider world rejects because of, you know, observable science and all that stuff, that there's a designer. But again, he says that's a philosophical question that you cannot prove or disprove. But because we've moved in this quote-unquote progress direction where we can do anything, it seems like we've become almost infinite, has that led to flourishing? Has that led to our fruition? And
right.
He says hard no.
Yeah.
But the natural world especially that he talks about is so important. I mean, he talks about the land a lot, you know, and there's one vivid scene where he's going through a grocery store and all he could see was the artificial, like, beams and how all of the food packaged on the shelves to look identical, how utterly different that is from most humans who knew their food sources, and that's maybe some of his past coming out there. But I do think he's onto that this industry and commercialism is created this very odd world that we live in, that you can go and get sometimes very artificial food and whatnot. But the natural world, his appeal to the natural world and the limits that we have in it was the most compelling thing to me. And we actually talked about, who here's read Brave New World before? Heard of it? Yeah, some more hands on Brave New World. That there were a lot of ties to that, mm-hmm. I feel like. And mm-hmm. If you haven't read it, I'll go ahead and spoil it now. There's basically this civilization that has all this technology, and they can take this drug that makes them feel good all the time, and the family and all the stresses of the family of raising children, that's now on the state. They're producing these children, and you can have like all the sex you want. It's kind of this culture. And then the main guy goes to a faraway land where none of that's there, and it's
savage,
painful, yes. And there's limits, and he comes to desire the natural world again. And that's a little bit of the way that I left this book, was like, oh, that longing for sweat and pain and toil, but also the richness that can produce in the natural world is a good thing, and we've lost that.
Yeah, and I think that the whole idea of what does it mean to flourish is so much a part of this, and that having limits is one of the ways to begin to experience joy, and that we are constantly sold this idea of more, 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 cram more into the day, do more things, be on more platforms, do all of these things, and that we have lost the sense of being able to be still, to be quiet, to really see anything, to really love. And so much of that is caught up with a problem with our definitions. Because when you look, and this is an area that Elul actually did a lot of work in, on what is the word free, what does the word freedom actually mean? Because we in our culture misunderstand that, because classically what freedom meant was that you were free from oppression and tyranny, and that you were free, particularly in a Christian worldview, you were free to live out what God had called you to. And that you are free to live a life of virtue and meaning and purpose that would make the world a better place without people imposing things that would stop you from doing that. So that is the classical meaning of freedom and liberty. There was another word that was used, it was license. License is the ability to do whatever you want. And license, the word that comes after that is licentiousness, which is all over the New mm-hmm. Testament, which basically means lawlessness. And that is roundly condemned as a road to death. But in our culture, we think freedom means license. We think freedom means the absence of any constraint whatsoever, and that any constraint on our freedom and our self-definition is evil. But the problem with that is it does not lead to flourishing. It leads to brokenness and death.
Yeah. Well, it's probably about time to throw it open to questions. Are there any last thoughts quickly about, maybe next time we'll talk about some critiques of the book or hopeful things that we can do?
Next time we're going to talk about some things that are some critiques, but we're also going to talk about some practices that you might want to think about based on what he has to say.
Yeah.
So, yeah. We could talk for about 10 hours but we're not going to. So we would love to hear your questions about this or about anything else. So you can go ahead and put those in, and you can upvote ones that you think are interesting that other people have posed, and then we will start diving into those.
Okay.
We've got a couple of questions to start with for right now. Let's go with the first one, and this one is one I was thinking of. I did not ask this one, though. What connections have you found between this book and C.S. Lewis, especially his book, Abolition of Man? What about connections to Wendell Berry?
Oh, yeah.
Even plant that question. so good. So there are so many connections. So Lewis's Abolition of Man and his novel, That Hideous Strength, which he said was the fictional depiction of the principles in the Abolition of Man, it is making exactly the same arguments. I mean, really exactly the same arguments. The unmaking of humanity, you could switch that with abolition of man. They're seeing exactly the same things. The difference is King's North is seeing the fruition of a lot of the things that Lewis saw when they were in their nascent state. I also think there's a big connection with Wendell Berry. Wendell Berry writes beautifully and movingly about nature and how important being connected with nature is. So I think there's a huge amount of resonance. And one of the things that, if you read this book and you really like it, I would also really recommend reading a poem that J.R.R. Tolkien wrote for C.S. Lewis when Lewis had converted to Christianity, which is a dialogue between these two points of view. And it's called Mythopoeia, which is a mouthful. But the whole last part of the poem is about progress with a capital P and how it has become a god and that it must be resisted. And one of the lines is, if by God's mercy progress ever ends. So there's a deep, deep resonance there, which to me makes this book all the more compelling, because it's like someone taking the arguments that were made back in the 1940s and saying, wake up and smell the coffee, look at what is actually happening.
Yeah, I would say the end of Abolition of Man is that novel really is kind of the antidote that is picking up on the very things that King's North is picking up on. And I think what, maybe this is a teaser towards next time, but what do you do in light of that?
Well, yes,
I would say the basically renunciation of greed and self-promotion is a major part of that. And then recognizing living simply. I think that's kind of a very big picture. Even his own life, I mean, just a simple life that is connected to the natural world. And that includes not just the land, but people and deep friendships. Inefficiency is actually, we've grown to idolize efficiency, but conversations
human contact
is not efficient. Otherwise, you would never have the self-checkout lane in the grocery store, but that is exactly why you have that. And so simple living that's connected to the natural world, that's very much one of the major points of that hideous strength. And I think he's making the same point.
Yes, for sure. Great question, whoever said that.
A little bit off topic, how do we explain to those following heretical versions of the gospel or Muslims that there is no other version of Christ than what the gospel teaches?
That is an excellent question. So there are all sorts of ways, I can't remember who said this, but that we love to make God in our own image, mm-hmm. and that has been the human tendency for a long time. But I think if you have someone that is genuinely interested, who's genuinely seeking truth, one of the things to do is to look at the actual evidence for Jesus and the evidence for the Gospels. Because if you look at the actual evidence for Jesus, if you look at the secular sources that wrote about Jesus, whether it is Tacitus or Suetonius or Josephus or any of those people who don't like Jesus, but they write about him and say, he lived at this particular time under Pontius Pilate. He was put to death by crucifixion. He claimed he was the Son of God, and his followers claimed that he rose from the dead. And then you look at the gospel narratives, and you look at a book like Peter Williams' Can We Trust the Gospels, which I feel like I have to keep plugging.
I was waiting for that. It took a long time to get there. It's so good.
I mean, if people would just read that book, so many of their doubts about the gospel would go away. But I think once if people have looked at that and looked at Williams' book, it's very hard to make the arguments that the Muslims make about who Jesus is, or that people make when they want to sort of reinvent Jesus as Jesus the revolutionary, or, you know, Jesus the whatever.
Yeah. And the various, it's not apocryphal. All the other non-canonical,
yes.
quote-unquote, gospels.
Yes.
The Gnostic ones, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Peter, these are not only much, much later, and that's even the secular New Testament scholars will affirm that, but the very content is so substantially different. But Peter Williams' book, Can We Trust the Gospels, is a great place to go.
Next question. How can we not get sucked into the big machine while still being a part of society? Work on a laptop, everyone has phones, etc.
Yes, yeah. That is an excellent question. We will go into that in a lot more depth next time. What is his thing where he talks about the cooked? The cooked worm and the raw worm or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
He talks about if you're in where you have to use it, the way that you deal with it is different than somebody where it's just strictly optional about their use of it. But a lot of it involves limits, setting limits on the amount of time, using the ability to be outside. He's a big believer in being outside, being connected to creation, and being connected to nature, and that can be an antidote. And if he'd been at our last tot, I'm sure he would have said reading actual physical books is really good. I think a lot of that research came out probably right after he had been writing this book. But you know, we talked about how there's a lot of research now that reading actual physical books, particularly fiction, can undo the rewiring of your brain that screens cause and can restore a lot of the things in your sensory cortex that get destroyed by being on screens all the time.
I can't remember how he frames it. He's like, on the far extreme, you can, I think like himself, he doesn't use any facial recognition technology.
Yep.
Think of the
no
amount.
No QR codes.
Yeah, the amount of stuff that
Sorry we gave you QR codes.
basically says no to that would make your life really challenging in some ways. Or on the other side, it's like what you mentioned earlier, David Foster Wallace. Once you know what water is and that you're swimming in it, you can begin to resist it. And that can be in smaller ways and being aware that, all right, I'm going to use this laptop if I have to do work. You can begin to try to prioritize the natural world in work. One of the things that we're doing in our school is like, do we really have to use email as much? I'm the headmaster of a new school, and I'm like, do we have to use email really this much? Or can we actually say, I know it's inconvenient, but I actually want to speak to you over the phone or in person because that's valuable. And I think that gets to some of this. Like, those are small ways that you can resist the machine.
But more on that next time.
Yeah.
Excellent question.
Have you changed how you live your life at all in response to this book?
Yes and no. So I just have read it in the past month, so I haven't had a lot of time to reflect on it. But one of the things that it has definitely made me do is be much more intentional about being outside. And this may sound really strange, but buying plants and taking care of them.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
And there is something about that, because you cannot control what's happening with the plant. But there is wonder that the plant is like producing flowers or producing fruit. And just the idea that you're spending some time cultivating it and thinking about it and bringing water to it, I have found that to be really helpful. And I also, and this is maybe a combo of this book and what we've been talking about in theology on Tuesdays the past couple of sessions, I've been much more intentional about reading and not watching things on a screen. I'm sort of predisposed that way anyhow, but I'm even more predisposed. I never liked my Kindle, and now I know why. I've been buying more paper and cardboard real books.
Like you, I think reading this book gave me an excuse to do the things I was already doing that I loved buying all these books. But actually, truth be told, I started gardening as well in light of this.
You really?
I really did. We started.
We should compare notes.
That was eerie. That I felt like you've been watching what we've been doing at the Hare household. But
yeah, CCTV. I have your feed.
Everything you said, I completely agree with. Like,
actually a bot.
That's right. But seeing the progress of a plant come to fruition and realize, like, I don't know how that does that. That's amazing.
Right.
Out of the soil, it was nothing, and now it's producing
bell peppers.
Yeah. And it may die,
if I don't do something about
it. So. Yep.
Why do you feel Christianity is necessary to be anti-machine?
Oh, I don't think it is.
Yeah.
I think it is the richest way of being anti-machine, because I think that the Christian faith brings with it a whole panoply of things that are deeply rooted. And I would say that the Christian faith has the most profound and satisfying understanding of what is true, what is beautiful, and what is good of any system of thought. And that the more of that that you have, the better your chances are of being able to lean into these four P's and not lean into the S's. But I think even without Christianity, you can, when you become aware, you know, the whole idea of adopting limits, even without Christianity, will help you not embrace this as fully.
Yeah, and I think, even though, as I mentioned, the beginning part of the book, he talks about the Christian story, and he's recently converted to is it Eastern Orthodox? I can't remember exactly. But I think all he's doing there is he talks about the Christian stories. He's making just a historical point of fact that the Western world has been shaped by Christianity. And any number of scholars and historians have pointed to that same thing. So it's not trying to say you have to be a Christian to you know, go against the machine. I think, as you said, it does help you notice all the flaws in the machine, probably the most vivid ways. But it's precisely because that you don't have to be a Christian to push back on that. But it's anyone, I think, today can feel why this isn't exactly right. Like the artificial, that which is purely imitation, we know deep down instinctively that
there's something wrong.
And that's it goes back to this picture, right? You're like, oh, that doesn't feel right. Actually, there's something off about it, and I think it's because you don't have to be a Christian, but anyone can go, that's not quite right, and I'm feeling pulled or drawn into a different direction.
And I think, you know, part of the reason for that, and part of the reason that you don't have to be a Christian, is that in the Christian understanding, God made all of us and made us in his image and made his creation, and even if you are not a Christian, you are living in a world that God made, and you're living in a body that God made in the Christian understanding. And because of that, you will find that certain things are true, whether you believe the Christian faith or not.
If you run into a wall, but you're not a Christian, it's still going to hurt.
Yeah, or if you jump off a building, gravity is going to get you.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Can we get a little appetizer of your critiques?
Sure. One of the things that I think about the book is that sometimes he wants to have a foot on both sides of the fence, and
there's a big mice up there.
I'm not sure what that is, but it's very interesting. I think sometimes he wants to have a foot on both sides of the fence, and I think that makes it a little bit harder to figure out what he's actually saying. Some people would say, well, that's because he's conflicted and he's just being honest. So, I mean, you can sort of argue that either way. I also think that his theology of freedom is a little bit confused in some places. I think that he is a little bit too prone to say, for example, all the period of what we think of the 18th century as the period of revolution, that it might, and he makes some statements where he thinks it might have been better if none of that had happened. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't personally agree with that. Yeah. I think that's an overstatement. But, you know, there are some places where he does genuinely say he's conflicted about something. So that's, I guess, a plus in that area.
We were talking about, you know, the chapter on the black ships that came in. And so he's talking about this was in Japan and how global trade, he kind of just really paints a negative picture of that. And while I think he picks up on right things, but takes them perhaps to an extreme, and this is a great instance of it, that global economy is not an evil in and of itself. And he often goes right up to that point, I feel like, in there.
Yeah.
Now, he's very much against untethered capitalism, and maybe rightly so, because our propensity towards greed. But, you know, the other things that... the idea that all progress is bad, I mean, he almost goes... That's another area that you're like, well, it's nice to have penicillin today.
Right.
You know,
yes.
I'm grateful for the things that have happened.
Dentistry.
Yes, right.
Novocaine.
And air conditioning is actually, you know, he would probably look at the whole effect. He is a genius, right? I mean, like, so looking at what inventions like that have caused on a mass scale, but... I'm tempted more to critique and say, you know, in their proper place,
right?
These things are not necessarily some things that he says, because I do think, yeah, there are others that I agree with him completely.
Yeah, and sometimes he may just be using hyperbole for the sake of emphasis.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say.
And then we got a Tolkien question. How much of the scouring of the Shire was based on the effects of progress?
I think a lot of it. At the risk of nerding out for those who are not so familiar, the scouring of the Shire happens when there is a power vacuum among the hobbits who have not really ever needed to worry about power or anything like that and have just lived locally and kind of done their own thing. And then while the great battle of the Ring and against the forces of Mordor is going on, some evil folk come into the Shire and decide to make it more efficient in some ways and to milk it for what they can get out of it. And it's sort of a classic example of people that are concerned only for progress and who basically come in and just destroy a culture. So I think that's very much on Tolkien's mind. Whenever you see people that are cutting down trees in any work of Tolkien, you know that that is an analog for progress and that it's evil. Did you want to wade into
that? Amen. That was great. Yeah.
How do you know if you are a fish in the dirty water? What are signs that you're in the dirty water? How do you get out? That can be tough.
That's such an excellent question. We'll probably talk more about that next time, but I think one of the signs that you're in the dirty water and that you are getting deeper into the dirty water is if you find that you cannot stop touching your phone. And I think that that is something, I mean, I struggle with that. Part of the thing that's really tricky is when you're in the clergy, you're supposed to be accessible to people. And so you can't not pay any attention to your phone, but the flip side of that is every time it does something, you don't want to respond to it. So I think that phone, screen time, that's a major symptom of where you are in the dirty water. I also think if you find that most of your interactions with people are online or through some sort of interface rather than in person, that is a pretty good sign. If you can go for days without actually interacting in person with someone else, you are deep in the dirty water.
Yeah, dirty water, you went very concrete, I'm going to go abstract on this,
okay.
But the idea that if you're swimming in dirty water, you're not going to survive. And if you're feeling like you're about to die
under.
Or to go under, or it's just you're struggling, basically that can be an analogy of things aren't right, and I can begin to feel it. And I think, some of what you just talked about, you put your finger on the tensions that we all experience in this day and age. And most of the communication, it can be so easy just to text or call as opposed to being in person. And while you're a clergy and you're supposed to be accessible, you also want to shepherd people in the way that
right,
they ought to
right.
go. And it's... That takes wisdom to both probably respond, but also redirect into a more excellent way.
Yeah.
But I think, how do you know if you're in dirty water? Well, take an audit of your life, notice if are you really doing well, or are you really actually flourishing? And there's something objective about when, if you are in fact a creature and your design is to be in relationships, living the way God intended, there is a wholeness. That's what shalom actually is all about. There's a peace that in every aspect is integrated.
Yep.
And I think we're in a disintegrated part of existence
for
now.
Sure. Maybe one more?
Yeah.
And there's one more question left. Has this book affected your view on end time prophecy, the mark of the beast, Revelation, etc., and how?
That's really interesting.
No. I don't think so. It does, I think, raise some interesting questions with regard to end times, because part of what he talks about, and I wish he had expanded a little bit more about this, but you know, the scriptures talk a lot about principalities and powers and the forces of evil that are demonic. And he touches on that several times in here. But I don't spend a lot of time thinking about end times, because I am more compelled by Jesus' statement that no one will know the hour, and that it will be like a thief in the night. And the most important thing for us to do is not worry about when it's going to be, but to be living as if we are in those times.
To be ready.
Yeah.
And I think that's very similar to my experience in this. I wasn't trying to predict the day of the end times where Jesus returns or whatever, but I think it did make me think a little bit about the, you know, he's talking about AI a good bit in here, and the creators of that, and the reasons why they were doing it. Do you recall? He was like, they felt compelled to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting
to
word.
To usher in something.
To usher in something. They didn't even know what it was, but he did. That's the language of spiritual forces.
Yeah.
And he's just recognizing these are the exact words of those who are on the cutting edge of creating all this stuff. So I didn't walk away going like, now is... But it did make me feel this is really important and something that, you know, maybe it is. But either way, the Bible does say we should be ready for Jesus' return. And that's going to be a good thing. That's ultimately the things we're experiencing right now are certainly challenging and confusing. There are many benefits on the one hand, but this is a pretty unique point in all of history where you can do things that are unimaginable 50, 60 years ago, but we're at the point now, well, should we be doing these things?
Right.
And that's a spiritual, philosophical question.
Yes.
So.
Well, those were great questions. Thank you all so much for coming. Please come for part 2, which will be full of hopeful practices.
Yeah.
So.
Thanks.
All right, thanks for coming.